to right field. You can kiss it goodbye. Oh, baby, did he get that baby out of sight.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the 60 Feet, 6 Inches podcast for the week of August 2nd. And this is actually our first podcast. I am Peter.
And I'm Nate.
And we'd like to thank you for listening. Since this is our first podcast, a lot of people that we know that we've been talking to said that we should introduce ourselves for those of you that may not read our blog. So I guess that means that we should probably do some sort of introduction.
All right, I'm Nate, and I write for 60 Feet, 6 Inches, and if you guys haven't checked us out yet, you should, and you should read us regularly. We're found at www.60feet6inches.com, that's S-I-X-T-Y-F-T-X-I-N.com. And I'm a fan of baseball, football, and hockey. All of my teams are the Pittsburgh teams, so I'm a fan of the Steelers, Pirates, and Penguins. And that's me. I'll turn it over to Peter now.
I'm Peter. I am a baseball and hockey fan, first and foremost, and I can explain to you for hours on end why I love those sports. Meanwhile, I'm also a basketball fan, but I can't explain that, beyond the fact that I'm from Indiana, and it's honestly one of those things that's just kind of ingrained from you from birth. I really have no explanation for why I love basketball besides the fact that I do, and it's a fun sport to watch for me. I'm from Indiana, and I absolutely love the Indiana Pacers. I also love the Chicago Blackhawks because I spent my youth growing up in the Chicagoland area, and some of my fondest memories are going to Blackhawks games with my dad, so it's always been one of the reasons why I will never abandon the Chicago Blackhawks. It's just because there's all that memory built up there. And then my father moved to Tampa Bay when I was younger, so I ended up spending my summers down there with him. Watched a lot of bad baseball down in Tampa up until last season. And last season was probably the greatest thing ever for all 2,000 of us Rays fans before the beginning of the year. So I'm a diehard Rays fan. I love the Blackhawks. I love the Pacers. And I think that's about it. I'm not that big of a football fan just because of ESPN's nonstop coverage of the sport and the actions of one Jim Irsay. One other thing that you should know about me is that I absolutely hate bandwagon jumpers. Bandwagon jumpers don't get it. They don't understand what being a fan is about. Being a fan is about suffering and enjoying success with your team. It's not about just enjoying all the success you can find and cheering on the team that's winning. There's a lot that goes into a fan, and I think that's why a lot of people don't like people that are fair weather fans or bandwagon jumpers, because if you don't suffer with a team, then when they actually win, it doesn't mean the same thing. It's not as great. And the other thing is to a lot of very passionate, very hardcore fans of any team, if you see somebody being a fair weather fan or bandwagon jumping when your team succeeds, it's kind of like they're pissing all over your parade as well, and it angers me at least just to see that, regardless of what team it is. I honestly feel bad for a lot of Yankees and Red Sox fans who've had to deal with the influx of all these people who aren't from those areas. Oh yeah, let's go Sox. No, you're from Utah. Don't try to fake a Boston accent. Alright, so enough about us. Let's move on to the trade deadline, which occurred on Friday, and let's recap some of the bigger trades. Let's start with the Jake Peavy trade. Jake Peavy was traded to the White Sox for Aaron Pareda, Clayton Richard, Dexter Carter, and Adam Russell. This trade occurred almost exactly at the 4 o'clock hour. It ended up with Jake Peavy having to accept the trade to override his no-trade clause.
This is obviously a big acquisition for the White Sox. It gives them an ace of the staff and could possibly put them over the top of the division. I think it was a good move for them. They gave up a lot, but not really as much as you would expect them to give up for Jake Peavy. So I think good move for them, and I think decent move for the Padres. I really believe they could have gotten more and didn't. So, depending on how Richard and Parita turn out, they might regret this trade. They might always look back at it and say, "Well, we should have traded him, but we could have gotten more."
One thing that's kind of concerning for me, at least, is the White Sox are in the middle of an AL Central race, and with that, you trade away your fifth starter in the rotation, who's young and has a lot of hope for the future, which it makes sense why he was included in that deal. I'm not saying that it's stupid that he was included. It's just kind of concerning when you're tied in a very tight race in a division that has no prospect of winning the wild card. So you have to win this division. You give away a solid rotation man who, according to most reports from White Sox fans I've talked to, was getting better with each start, for Jake Peavy, who's still recovering from an injury. With Peavy recovering from this injury, he's not going to be back, at least according to his press conference, he's not going to be back until the end of August. So you give up a guy that's a solid rotation man in a tight race when your competitors, the Detroit Tigers, have stocked up on the deadline. It's slightly concerning to me to think about, just because the potential for a huge drop-off in those next 3 weeks until Peavy gets back is high. I'm not saying the White Sox can't hold their own, especially if you look at the most recent series they had with the Yankees. You can tell they can hold their own, definitely, but it's a matter of, did they give away too much essential personnel right now for somebody who's not going to be here until a few weeks from now?
I see the point, but I think it was the best move for the White Sox, because at worst, what's going to happen is they might lose every fifth day, and they have a starter every fifth day that's kind of shaky and doesn't give them the best chance to win, and that's terrible, but they've gained Jake Peavy from it, and if he can come back and be healthy, then I think it more than makes up for the few weeks of having a bad fifth starter, which is typically the most replaceable starter in a rotation anyway.
That's true. The point I was just making is not necessarily having to do with the starter's spot in the rotation, but more or less the fact that this was a young pitcher who was developing well and was providing solid starts from the fifth position.
Yeah, and they gave up a lot of potential with Parada, and they gave up a good deal of their future, but it's not about the future for them right now. It's about winning this year. So, in that regard, I think it was the right move.
That's true, I agree. It's the one thing about this trade that's different from a lot of the deadline deals is that Peavy is not a rental. He's not here for a year or 2 years, however long he has left in his contract. Peavy, at least according to the White Sox front office, will be there 4 years to come. They're going to re-sign him when his contract is up, and they're going to bring him back. They want Peavy to be there as the ace of their rotation for at least, I don't know, the next half decade?
I honestly sort of question the wisdom of that for the long term, because Peavy is an aging starter. He's been gone with an injury for a lot of this year, and he's still good. He's still one of the best starters in the league, but at his age, you have to wonder how long he can keep that up. I mean, I guess Randy Johnson did it, so maybe Jake Peavy can too.
That's true, although the conventional wisdom in Chicago is that Jerry Reinsdorf isn't that great of an owner, so I'm sure this type of logic easily prevails on the south side of Chicago. Let's move on now to another one of the big deals that happened, which was the Cliff Lee trade, which sent Cliff Lee and Ben Francisco to the Phillies in exchange for Lou Marson, Jason Knapp, Jason Donald, and Carlos Carrasco.
This is obviously a big trade for both teams here. The Indians traded away an ace in Cliff Lee and got back a boatload of prospects that they're hoping are going to pan out in future years and be a big part of their team for years to come. And let's not forget that Cliff Lee was acquired in a similar trade when they traded Bartolo Colon and got Cliff Lee, Grady Sizemore, Brandon Phillips, and somebody else that didn't pan out. I honestly forget his name. And at the time, that move was widely unpopular in Cleveland as well, but I don't think many people would take that trade back for Bartolo Colon anymore. So, time will tell on these prospects. As for Philadelphia, it gives them another ace to put at the top of their rotation. It solidifies a lot of their team. It puts them in the hunt for the division. So I like this move for both sides. I feel like both GMs really knew what they were doing here, and time will tell on who's the true winner of this trade. But right now, it seems like a fair deal for both sides.
Looking right now at the statistics for all the prospects that were included in this deal, almost all of them are hitting near 300 in low A ball, or in some variant of the minor leagues. Right now, Lou Marcin, I hope I'm saying that name right, I'm probably not, is batting .288 this year in AAA ball, and has a .375 on-base percentage. That's has a pretty good prospect that's going to end up being in Cleveland very shortly, it looks like.
It seems like a lot of the talent they got back here was near major league ready, and it could play a big part in Cleveland's success or failure as early as next season. So, time will tell, but I tend to trust that Mark Shapiro is a good GM and knows what he's doing.
Yeah, just some other highlights from the statistics of these players. Jason Knapp currently has 111 strikeouts and 17 starts in low A ball. Jason Donald has a slugging percentage of .324 in rookie league and AAA this year, just throughout the minors. That's what he's been averaging. And Carlos Carrasco is averaging 8 strikeouts per 9 innings in AAA this season. So most of these prospects are definitely worth Cliff Lee. The question is, will they pan out to be worth Cliff Lee?
Right, it's always a risky proposition trading good players for prospects, but it's one that small market teams like Cleveland have to do, and I think it's good that they're willing to make the unpopular moves if it benefits their team in the long term.
The real question then shifts to be, will this trade help Cleveland down the stretch, or is this just another one of those big ace pitcher deals that doesn't end up panning out in the end?
Yeah, I think it helps them down the stretch, because anytime you add a solid rotation, a solid starter to your rotation, good things can happen. Cliff Lee gives them a chance to win every fifth day, and they've already got a good rotation over in Philadelphia, so all he does is solidify this, back up their great offense, and, you know, these are the defending World Series champions, and not much has changed about their team except for the addition of Cliff Lee. I think it's possible that they could repeat or at least go deep into the playoffs.
The Phillies have had problems all year long, though, with keeping their pitching staff healthy. So far, they even brought in Pedro Martinez to try and shore up things, but he's still stuck in AAA, I think.
He is. Martinez is still injured, actually. He's still on the DL. So it'll be a while before he even joins the team. And when he joins the team, it's questionable over whether he'll even be good or not. He hasn't been Pedro Martinez for the last few years. But, you know, they have a rotation that features Cole Hamels and Cliff Lee as the 1-2 punch right now. It bumped Jamie Moyer all the way down to their number 4 starters, so I think it signifies that they have strong pitching and they have strong pitching depth.
It does make their pitching staff a lot stronger. The thing, though, is, will this help them repeat? And Jason, I cited this in a recent story that I posted on the blog. Jason Stark, in one of his ESPN articles entitled "The Biggest Myths About the Trade Deadline," writes, "Over the past 32 years, exactly 3 pitchers have changed teams in midseason and won a World Series game. Joe Blanton for the 2008 Phillies, Jeff Weaver for the 2006 Cardinals, and Mike Torres for the 1977 Yankees. Combined Cy Young awards for these 3 guys? That would be 0. And it's an interesting thought that we see every year these big ace deals going down. Like we saw the Peavy deal and the Cliff Lee deal. But historically, it's shown that this type of trade doesn't pan out for a World Series ring, it may lead you deep into the playoffs, but these deals don't pan out as giving you a World Series ring.
No, but I'd argue that it definitely gives you a better shot at a World Series ring. I mean, despite what's happened in the last so many years, Cliff Lee has still been a good pitcher for the last few years, and he definitely adds depth to the Phillies' rotation. It's a question of how much he can do, because he does only go out there every fifth day, but do you really think that the Brewers would have even made the playoffs last year without CC Sabathia? No, that was a chance that they had to take. They took it, and it ended up well, but it didn't completely pan out for them.
Oh, and I agree with that. I believe that those deals do help you get into the playoffs and help you move in the playoffs. I'm just saying that historically, these deals do not contribute to a World Series ring, which is the popular misconception about these type of deadline deals.
Well, that's true, but we can define contributing to a World Series ring a lot of different ways, too. I mean, the Rays lost the World Series last year, but are we going to argue that it's a bad idea for them to build through the minor league system because that hasn't won them a World Series yet?
No, but I think eventually the Rays, the A's, or the Pirates, teams that are building through their minor league system, are eventually going to win a World Series. And that kind of actually brings us to another big thing that went down, which was the Pirates' fire sale right along the trade deadline.
Yeah, the Pirates made a lot of big trades this year. Of the 8 starting position players at the beginning of the 2009 season, only 2 remain on the team. That's catcher Ryan Domit and third baseman Andy LaRoche. They traded basically all of them for prospects at various levels of the minor leagues. For example, Niger Morgan was traded for Lastings Millage, and Millage is in the major leagues now, as well as Sean Burnett for Joel Hanrahan, who was also in the major leagues. Basically, every move they made was in an attempt to get younger, to build the core of the minor league system, to lay down a foundation of sustainable players. When you watch ESPN or the big mainstream media talk about these trades, they all hate them. They all pan them universally. I like these moves because the way I see it, the 2007 Pirates had Freddie Sanchez, Adam LaRoche, Jason Bay, Nate McLeod, Xavier Nady, Jack Wilson, Tom Gorzolani, and Ian Snell, all players that were traded this year. And Niger Morgan, I should add. All players that were traded this year, and they won 68 games this year. That says to me that none of these players are sustainable to build a championship foundation around. So, if we can't win with them, we might as well build from the ground up and win without them.
And that seems like a solid move. A lot of teams have been doing that recently. We see a resurgence of, let's build up our minor league and let's build up a strong foundation. And this seems to be the recipe for building success in a smaller market. Tampa Bay actually proved that you can win in the playoffs with a Moneyball type system. And that's the rise of sabermetrics is only helping to push for these type of teams to be built. It's kind of funny that we're seeing now a return to what was commonplace, what was popular in the early days of baseball, where you built up to your farm system instead of what we've seen for the last 15 years with, we need to buy up everyone who was ever good at any point in free agency, and then we need to trade at the deadline for big deals.
Yeah, it is a different approach, and I would argue that a good deal of World Series teams are starting to build through the minor leagues as well. You look at the 2007 Red Sox, and their entire core came through their minor league system. Jason Varitek came up through their system. Kevin Youkilis came up through their system. Dustin Pedroia, Jacoby Ellsbury, John Lester, Clay Buchholz, Jonathan Papelbon. These guys all came up through the minor league system to the Red Sox. And true, they did supplement that with free agency and trades, you know, getting the Manny Ramirez's, the David Ortiz's through that kind of venue. most of their core came through their minor league system. And surprisingly enough, you look at the Yankees right now, and it's the same way. Over half of their current major league roster came up through their minor league system. So I think it's not just small market teams, it's large market teams as well. Everybody's building through the minors right now. I doubt there's ever been a point in baseball history where prospects were valued so highly.
Especially after what the Rays have done, it helps to boost the need to build young. Because Tampa is going to be competitive for years, so this isn't something that's going to be a one-time deal and it's over. And you're going to see the same thing with the Pirates starting probably in 2011.
Yeah, it's a big movement to build towards the minor leagues, and I'm a fan of it because as a baseball fan, it sort of gives people a sense of connection to the team as well. You look up these prospects and watch them progress through the minor leagues. They come up to the major leagues, the team controls their contractual rights for the first 6 years of their career. It's not a constant hot stove like it was before, where you'd trade big-name major leaguers for other big-name major leaguers, and as soon as you buy your favorite player's jersey, he's off your team. And that's how it was for a lot of teams, be it the Yankees and the Red Sox or the Pirates and the Rays for a lot of years.
I'm also sure that you are very happy that the Pirates are building up prospects considering you live in their AAA affiliate city.
Yeah, it's a big deal for me to get to see these guys before they make it to the major leagues. Before they make a splash there, I can do my own, like, miniature scouting report of them at the AAA game.
Yeah, and it's probably very exciting to watch these prospects come up, as I will get to watch them also play and only see them for about half a season before they go up to the major leagues. So at least I'll be able to tell my grandkids I saw the great so-and-so when he was young, or the great Andrew McCutchen, who had 3 home runs the day after I take him off my fantasy team. Let's move on now to one of the other big trades that occurred, which was the Victor Martinez trade. This also occurred within hours of the trade deadline.
But I just want to add a funny aside to this trade. Adam LaRoche, one of the players traded from the Pirates to the Red Sox, was once again traded from the Red Sox back to his original team, the Atlanta Braves, as a result of this trade. So I just thought it was kind of funny, you know, one guy's traded twice in one deadline. And honestly, all the teams got back from him was mediocrity both times.
Well, LaRoche gets to go join his former teammate, now his teammate again, Nate McLaughlin, in Atlanta, so I'm sure he's stoked about that.
Yeah, I'm sure he's happy, not only about rejoining Nate McLaughlin, but also about going to a contender. But this isn't about Adam LaRoche. Let's stop talking about Adam LaRoche. Let's get on to Victor Martinez right now, and what this means for the Red Sox and what it means for the Indians.
This trade for the Red Sox means that they now have some maneuverability with their lineup card and have a solid backup catcher if they need it. Although it seems pretty obvious that Martinez is going to be playing at first, and the reason the Red Sox went after him was for his bat.
Yeah, there's also a possibility that he might be DHing some games. I doubt David Ortiz gets benched very often, but sometimes they might want to give him some rest and put Victor Martinez in the game as the DH instead.
That's true. Right now, according to the Red Sox depth chart, Victor Martinez is actually listed as the starting catcher and the backup first baseman. So we could be wrong, but that kind of goes against all logic to do it that way.
Yeah, and the MLB.com depth charts are a vortex of evil and lies, so I tend not to trust them.
That may be. Let's continue talking about this trade. The Indians, who had Victor Martinez bobblehead day the day after they traded Victor Martinez, which...
Hilarious.
Yes. Always good to have something like that going on. I still do not understand why you would schedule a bobblehead day the day after the trade deadline. I understand that they were predicted to win the AL Central if it wouldn't have been for injuries, but why do it the day after? Because you don't know what's going to happen. I'm sure they will now write something in some sort of manual that promotions people follow that says, do not do bobblehead day after trade deadline, ever. Because that was a wonderful promotion snafu. But let's get back to the trade. The Indians got Justin Masterson, Nick Hagedone, and Bryant Price in exchange for Victor Martinez. All of these guys are legitimate prospects.
Oh, yeah. The Victor Martinez trade may end up being a bigger trade for the Indians than the Cliff Lee trade was. I'm honestly surprised that the Red Sox would give up so much for them. The Indians got back three pitchers in this deal, two starters and a reliever. All of them are highly regarded. Masterson's currently in the major leagues as a reliever, and he's putting up solid numbers. Not awesome numbers, but good enough for a middle reliever. And this is going to hurt for Indians fans because on the surface, it looks like they traded Victor Martinez for a reliever. But that's really not the case. It's just that the starters are a few years off. But they are doing well in their minor league season so far. Nick Hagedone has 11.5 strikeouts per nine innings in low A Greenville right now. And that was after a 10.8 line last year and a 12.2 line the year before. So I think it's safe to say that he's a strikeout machine. And he also rarely walks anybody. So it looks like he's going to do pretty well. But it is worth noting that he's doing this as a 23-year-old in low A. So the test is going to be what he does when he moves up a level or two, when he gets up to double A, if he can keep this together. Bryant Price is 22 years old. He's a level higher than Hagedone. He's at high A right now, and he's putting up similarly good numbers. High strikeouts, low walks. The peripherals look pretty bad. He has a high whip and a high ERA, but those are in minor league ballparks where everything is a hit, so it's more useful for analytical purposes to just look at the strikeouts, the walks, and the fact that he's given up very few home runs and looks like a solid ground ball pitcher.
Looking at both the Victor Martinez and the Cliff Lee trades, it seems like Cleveland is going to be a force to reckon with in the next couple of years. If all these prospects pan out, this team is going to be a very, very good team, especially considering some of these guys are in AAA right now. And within a year or two, you could see Cleveland starting a reign of dominance in the AL Central.
Yeah, I'm not too excited about it because I honestly thought that the Indians would have been good this year and the year before that and the year after this. But it looks like they're trading away success in the near term for success in the long term. And while that's not necessarily a bad idea, I'm just not sure when it's going to pan out for them.
That's true, and that's always the question with prospects is, will it pan out? And if it does, when does it pan out? But if everything continues in the way it looks, Cleveland could be a very, very dominant team for years to come. While we're on the subject of teams and dominance, let's move forward with... It's something I've noticed, at least. The Cardinals, coming up to the trade deadline, traded away a large portion of their future, including AAA prospect, who was in the Futures game, Brett Wallace. Brett Wallace was actually recognized in St. Louis by Cardinals fans, and a lot of them were telling him, we want you up here soon. So it actually kind of came as a shock to me to see him be traded off like that.
Yeah, the Cardinals are trading a lot of their top prospects right now, and to their credit, a lot of the deals they've made have given them a great shot of competing this year, possibly for a World Series, and I think it was the right thing to do, but I don't know, they're going to have to rebuild their minor league system in the coming years in a big way.
St. Louis has plenty of chances in the next few years to restock and rebuild their now depleted minor league system, but with the way that the other teams in the NL Central are building, like the Reds and the Pirates, it's a little bit disconcerting, I would think, at least, to Cardinals fans, that right now is your chance to win it, and if you don't do it soon, you're not going to have a chance. Because some of the prospects that are coming up in the other NL Central markets look like the teams that are at the bottom right now are going to end up being the dominant ones, and we're going to see the NL Central flipped in about 3 years.
Yeah, I agree, because while the Cubs and the Cardinals and the Brewers have put themselves in the position for short-term success, which was the right move for them, don't get me wrong, the Pirates and the Reds have put themselves in the position for long-term success, and honestly, I see the Brewers sticking around for a little while because they built mostly through their minor league system, and most of their major league team right now is cost-controlled young players that'll be on the team for a long time. But the Cubs and the Cardinals specifically, I see as being now-or-never type teams, where if they don't win this year or possibly next year, they're just going to have to rebuild and try it again. And then the Astros basically just fail at everything, so I'm not even going to mention them.
Yeah, that seems about accurate. But they have that train and that hill in center field, so.
That's a stupid hill.
Don't get me started on that hill. I love that hill, and I love the fact the flagpoles are in play. But that is a different conversation for a different day. Let's move on to the last thing involving the trade deadline before we get into an argument about Tad's hill. It's difficult to say at this point, especially with the prospects involved, who is a winner and who is a loser. But I'm almost certain at this point that I would be correct in assessing the Cincinnati Reds as trade deadline losers.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they did there in trading for Scott Rolen. I don't see any sort of benefit for them because he's not going to help you win this year, and he's sure not going to help you win in coming years. Why trade for him?
One rumor that's persisting about this deal is that Rolen went to the GM of the Blue Jays and demanded a trade due to family issues. I know Rolen is from Indiana, and Cincinnati is the closest market to Indiana, well, at least most of the state. And if that's the case, then Walt Jocketty, the GM of the Reds, did something that was a very human, very non-business-like thing to do in a very business setting, which was trade and bring him back to somewhere where he may be more comfortable or maybe closer to family or something like that. But still, if that's the case, Walt Jocketty gave up too much stuff to pull off that kind of a deal. Regardless, if he was doing it to be a decent human being, he still lost.
Yeah, he lost badly, I would say. And I would also like to add that Jocketty wasn't hired to be a human being. He was hired very recently, in the middle of last year, to build a winning baseball team, and that should be focus number one. No matter what, this was a bad baseball trade for the Reds.
And what I'm saying is if he did do something to be very kind, that was incredibly nice of him to do, he just gave away too much stuff. He gave away way too many people in exchange for a player that's on the decline of his career and may have just been homesick, for all we know. And all of this is still speculation. We have no idea if this is even why this trade went down.
Yeah, I'm honestly going to say I don't think that's why it went down. I think Jocketty honestly thought that this was a good move for the Reds, and that should be horrifying to Reds fans.
Other rumors persisting are that the Reds are intending to re-sign Rolen when his contract runs out, which means he will be there long-term as a face of the franchise. That should be absolutely horrifying, because the only reason I could see that trade going down was so that he would be trade bait next year.
Maybe. But trading for this year to trade for next year seems way too convoluted for me, and I don't know, I really think that he thought that Rolen would do something to put them over the top. I don't get it.
I do not know either. I'm pretty sure that the Reds have a lot of prospects that are going to be coming up within the next 2 years, and maybe they thought a veteran presence like Rolen would help, but that still doesn't excuse this trade. This trade is bad across the board, and I know a lot of Reds fans they passionately love this team, and then this team rips their still-beating hearts out of their chest every year around the midway point of the season. And this is just over-the-top suffering for Reds fans this year, and I really do feel bad.
And now, I'll do my best impression of an ESPN anchor. And now on to the NFL, where we'll spend the next 3 hours.
Yeah, that seems accurate. All right. So, the NFL quarterbacks have been in the news recently. So has the NFL in general, but it seems like all the major news stories are about NFL quarterbacks.
Yeah, we have Michael Vick, Brett Favre, and Ben Roethlisberger are all big stories this offseason for different reasons. One's looking for reinstatement, one's looking to stay away from the game, and one's just looking to not be distracted as he's sued. So I think we should take a moment to break down all of these stories and the impact they have on their teams.
Let's start with Michael Vick. Michael Vick just got released from prison, had a meeting with Roger Goodell, and the conditions of the reinstatement state that he can pretty much be an active member of a team. He just can't play until preseason weeks 3 and 4. And then he can practice with the team, do everything with the team, but play in games until week 6. And even then, he still has to be reinstated at week 6.
Yeah, it's a weird reinstatement to me. It seems like a sort of half and half type of thing, where Roger Goodell is looking for the good publicity of the NFL allowing a reformed criminal to have a second chance on life, but he's not looking for the bad publicity of the NFL has a dogfighter in its league. Oh my God. And it just seems like what he's done is put it square in the middle where it doesn't help him, it doesn't help Michael Vick, it doesn't help the league. I think he needed to make a decision one way or the other. Either come out and say, Michael Vick has done his time, he's been in prison, we're going to allow him to play football. Or come out and say, Michael Vick has done his time, that said, we don't want him in this league. We don't want Michael Vick representing us.
Yeah, Roger Goodell in general, though, with his very odd dishing out of punishments, has always rubbed me the wrong way. There's no uniformity to the way he punishes his athletes.
Yeah, I like the idea of holding players accountable for their actions, and I like that he actually does something about it, unlike the previous commissioner, Paul Tagliabue, but there doesn't seem to be a method to any of his madness.
And it's always rubbed me the wrong way. Just as a fan, I used to watch the NFL all the time, and now I don't so much anymore, but when it's in the news, I see that one guy gets punished for 2 games, and another guy will get a slap on the wrist, and they did the exact same thing. And stuff like that drives me nuts. Punish them exactly the same. Don't do a case-by-case thing. There'll be more about Vic as it comes. One option that's always stuck in my mind as a good idea for Vic is to go play in the UFL. The reason I say this is because if Vic plays in the UFL, which their season, I believe, starts in September and ends on Thanksgiving, it would give him an opportunity to showcase his talents, prove to people he still had it, and then when week 6 rolls around, he can get picked up by an NFL team. It seems like a solid idea, but I think the whole athlete pride thing is going to play into it, and he's going to try and just play in the NFL instead, which may end up hurting him and lead to him becoming a Wildcat specialist for probably the remainder of his career.
Yeah, I agree. I just don't see him playing in the UFL. I don't see that being a thing that he undertakes. So we'll see how it pans out with him in the NFL.
That's true.
But for the moment, I think we should move on to Brett Favre, who is finally decided that he's actually going to stay retired this year.
Hooray! Finally.
Hooray!
That should have happened 3 years ago.
It should have happened 3 years ago, but Brett Favre likes to be in the limelight. I am only going to miss one thing about Brett Favre, and that's the 82-yard passes on a 2nd-and-2 situation, which he, you know, it's like, oh, it's 2nd-and-2, Brett Favre under the center, on the ball snap, fakes a handoff, and he throws 82 yards downfield to Donald Driver. I'm going to miss that.
Yeah, I'm going to miss that as well. I'm definitely going to miss that about Brett Favre, because it's just so ridiculous the way that he would play football sometimes, but it seemed to work for him.
Yeah, it seemed to work for him, except if you look at his completion to interception ratio, and you realize amongst all great all-time quarterbacks, especially in the modern era, that's incredibly high.
I wouldn't go so far as to say all-time. I mean, if you think about all-time quarterbacks, would you personally consider Terry Bradshaw, Johnny Unitas, and Roger Staubach good quarterbacks?
Yeah, and they all had high completion percentages. What I was saying, though, is especially amongst modern quarterbacks.
Yeah, amongst the modern guys, but I don't know. I think it still worked out for him. He still obviously won multiple Super Bowls, and he's going to go down as an all-time great. He just plays the game differently than almost every other quarterback plays at this era.
That's true.
We should move on to Ben Roethlisberger now.
Big Ben, who for some reason seems to find his name in the headlines every offseason after he wins a Super Bowl.
All two of them.
Well, let's see. You have a motorcycle accident and then an alleged rape.
Yeah, this is obviously serious, serious stuff for Ben Roethlisberger. I'm going to throw out there right now that I don't think he did it, mostly because of the track record of this woman, the shadiness of there being no criminal charges filed. All very anecdotal stuff, and I obviously don't know the situation personally. Only those two people know whether it happened or not. So, I hope the legal process plays itself out. I hope that he didn't do it. And I hope that this doesn't distract him from training camp.
I think it's going to be a distraction, no matter how you try to get it out of your head. It's going to be there in the back of your mind. And that honestly sucks, because I agree with you. I don't think that this happened. I think this woman who has had years of mental issues made this up, and it's not to say that, oh, because Ben Roethlisberger is who he is, this woman is lying. It's based off the evidence at hand, it appears that Big Ben is completely innocent.
Yeah, I think so as well, and I guess we'll have to wait and see what actually happens and reserve judgment for that. But one thing Ben Roethlisberger has to focus on is football, and like you said, this is obviously going to play a big distraction for him, because it's a big thing going on in his life. It's something off the football field that he's going to have to deal with constantly, and it's going to be all that the reporters want to talk about for a long time. But I think he needs to separate this from the game in his mind and focus on the game while he's playing it, and hopefully he'll be able to do that.
I hope this doesn't distract him as well, just for the billions of Steelers fans out there in the world, and just because stuff like this, if the woman is telling the truth, then I want Ben Roethlisberger to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
Yeah, and I want to say that too. Even as a Steelers fan, if the truth comes out and Ben Roethlisberger did it, I don't care that he's Ben Roethlisberger. I don't care that he's the quarterback of my favorite team. I want him to go to jail for a long time, which he won't because it's just a civil charge. But I want to see some maximum punishment exacted if this actually happened, because I don't think anybody is above the law.
The thing that bothers me is that I always think about is the hundreds, probably thousands of kids that idolize Ben Roethlisberger, that this may actually hurt them, or furthermore, how awkward does it have to be as a parent to try and explain to your kid what he's accused of? I always hate to see things like this come out in the media, just because I always think about that one thing. Like, if you're a dad and this comes out, you have to explain to your kid what he's accused of. You can't just go, oh, well, he got in trouble for doing bad stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a touchy issue for sure, especially, I'm sure, in Pittsburgh, where there are a lot of kids that are looking at, that are going to look up to Ben Roethlisberger. They see him as their hero, and also for that reason, I hope he's innocent, because I don't want anybody's hero to turn out to be a bad person.
That's true. It's always a very, very touchy subject, especially if Ben is innocent. If Ben is innocent, then this woman who, you know, it may be no fault of her own, it may just be psychological problems that she's had, but unknowingly has caused trouble to thousands of families just because you have to explain something like that. And it's not a huge, huge deal to explain it. It's still that awkwardness and that the potential loss of innocence, which always troubles me to a certain extent. Finally, we wanted to end on a lighter note, and this came across to me a couple days ago as I was looking up Jeff Bennett, who the Rays recently acquired off of waivers from Atlanta. Jeff Bennett is currently on a rehab assignment because he broke his hand after punching a wall, and if you're a pitcher, that's a pretty bad life choice to make.
Yeah, no doubt.
Which got us to thinking, what are some of the other hilarious Major League Baseball injuries we've heard of over the years? One of them that came to my mind was Oliver Perez. Oliver Perez kicked a towel cart and broke his toe. And I believe he went on the DL for a while.
Yeah, he did. And that's funny to me because it always makes me laugh when somebody gets frustrated and takes it out on an inanimate object, and that inanimate object ends up winning the fight with them.
That's always good. It's always good when something with less reasoning skills than you wins.
Yeah, it's sort of like my favorite funny MLB injury, which is never talked about, it seems like, and this should always be talked about. Somebody should bring this up every year, in my opinion, which is when Troy Tulowitzki, the shortstop for the Colorado Rockies, spent most of the first half of last season on the disabled list. He came back from the disabled list, immediately went into a slump, and got frustrated after he struck out, broke his bat in frustration, and the bat splintered and broke his hand, which put him right back on the disabled list.
That's always good. I love the inanimate object taking you out. Seriously, though, that's one of those things, like that video on YouTube where the guy kicks his skateboard after he breaks it and hits him in the face.
Yeah, it always cracks me up.
It's like, don't take your rage out on inanimate objects, because that can only end badly.
And then another one I want to talk about is Joel Zumaia, the relief pitcher for the Tigers, who one year during the AL Championship Series was playing too much Guitar Hero and pulled a tendon in his arm and had to sit out multiple games of the playoffs as a result of playing too much of a video game.
Didn't the trainer look at his wrist and say, this is not a pitching injury, this is from playing guitar, it looks like?
Yeah, he did. The trainer basically called him out on it when Zumaia said it was from pitching. And I'm sure that Jim Leland was just thrilled about his relief pitcher having to sit out of an AL Championship Series because of something that he did for recreation.
I would never want to be in a room with Jim Leland when he was angry. He just seems like one of those people that would be probably the most terrifying human being to be locked in a room with.
I agree, especially considering his track record with League Championship Series and being so close to the World Series and never quite making it. I don't think that I'd want to do anything to make it less likely for him to make it, because I think one day he will snap.
Well, Leland did get that one shot at the World Series, but of course it didn't turn out so well, as they got swept by the Cardinals in four games. I would still, though, never, ever could you pay me money to sit in a room with an angry Jim Leland. That, unless Jim Leland was restrained, and even then I think he might break the restraints.
Yeah, and I want to say that the funniest thing about this injury isn't the injury itself. It's that the Tigers actually have a rule now that no player for their team can play Guitar Hero during the baseball season.
Which is great, except the thing is that's a guitar-related injury. You could get that from playing a guitar or a bass. So I'm surprised they don't have a bylaw saying you can't do that either.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, injuries are always hilarious, especially when it's inanimate objects taking you out, or you do it in a stupid manner, and you have a manager who's going to kill you because you did that. Finally, we're going to do a trivia question. We're going to try and do a trivia question every week, and we are making a prize available. It's going to be something silly, like a postcard from Victory Field or whatnot. Of course, you can always decline the prize, and the winner will be the first person to email us at sixtyftsixin@gmail.com with the answer. And this week's trivia question is, in 1985, the city of Indianapolis tried to acquire a Major League Baseball team. A logo and nickname were created for this team. What was the name that was going to be given to the team? And again, that email address is sixtyftsixin@gmail.com. That's all we have. We'd like to thank you for listening to us. Our blog is updated almost daily at sixtyftsixin.com. That's 60 feet, 6 inches. We'd just like to thank all of you again for listening. I'm Peter.
I'm Nate.
And kiss the baby and put it to bed. We're done here.
That's the dumbest thing. That is the worst sign-off ever.